allow our kids to go through that door. I mean, realistically, $1 million, you could probably, if it was wisely spent, you could set your kids for life. Now, what if I make a caveat that in order to get that amount of money, you got to be able to go in and come out safely? And then I add the fact that 85 to 88% don't make it out alive. How's that looking to you now? How many of us would allow our children to risk going through that door for that amount of money, knowing that 85 to 88%, would we still let them go in? I dare say nobody in this room would want to gamble with those kinds of odds. And yet, realistically, those are the numbers every single year when we send our kids off to college. We're losing 85 to 88% of them. How in the world is that working for us? I mean, think about it. We keep doing the same thing, but we're expecting a different result. Well, let me share with you very quickly the result. The spiritual health, so to speak, of the church. I'm one of these guys, I like to use real numbers because I think that really helps us to see what's going on. If we were to open up the Churches of Christ directory, the most recent ones that we have, in the year 2006, we were at 1.24 million. As of 2009, we were sitting at 1.20. In other words, in just 3 years, we lost 40,000 people. We're going in the wrong direction. Folks, in 3 years, we should have grown. You think about where the church would be in Hopkinsville if we had kept every single one of our children faithful the last 25 years. And they'd married, and you've got two faithful people now having children who are faithful. I dare say every single one of the congregations in this county would be building larger buildings. And yet instead, let me share with you what we've got. This is an email that I received from a young man. He is now about 23 years old. Actually, he's about 24. His name is Cody. Look at what he wrote to me. Dr. Brad, I've been attending the Church of Christ all my life. Been a member since I was 12. 21 now. He wrote this a couple of years ago. I'm really having some problems with doubt. I've talked to you a few times before, but I know I've never just come completely clean and admitted the fact that I'm really am having a hard time with this. What do I do? Now, I wish that I could look at you and tell you these kinds of emails were foreign to me, but the reality is I get them just about every single week now. The difference in this particular email is that this young man is a preacher. He went through preaching school, and yet he's still filled with doubt. The same week that I received this one, I got another one from a young man named Matt. He says, my name is Matt. I'm a student at Tennessee Tech University. Grew up at Hartsville Pike Church of Christ in Gallatin. I'm just starting the second semester of my sophomore year, and I'm taking world literature. Okay, stop right there. If you think the only attacks on your children or grandchildren are coming in the form of a science class, you need to wake up. This guy's taking a literature class. He says, on the first day of class, my professor was talking about all the different things that we believe because other people have told us they're true. He started out by asking us, how many continents are there in the world today? The class answered 7. He made fun of them. He said, Europe and Asia are one landmass. His next question dealt with the virgin birth. He then proceeded to ramble on about original sin and what all Christians believe is a lie. At the end of the class, he says, we'll be talking about all the little piles of blank in your head, and by thinking, we will hopefully rid you of them throughout the semester. Folks, this is a world literature class, and we keep sending our kids thinking we're going to get a different result. This evening, I believe what we got to talk about is how do we prevent that? What do we need to do with our families? And the first step is inoculating them. What do I mean by that? Some of you remember back when you were younger, you used to get vaccines or booster shots. They would give you just a little bit of whatever it was so that your body could build up a defense against it. Likewise, I think we've got to start sharing with our children some of their arguments share just a little bit of what they're going to get a feel for so that they can build up a defense. Let me share with you what I mean exactly. A couple of years ago, there was a research study done in California. They wanted to know, how hard is it to get a young person to give up something they totally believe in? What does it take to get somebody to give up something that they believed all their life? They didn't want to mess with religion because they were afraid of what that would do lifelong. So they decided to set up an experiment to try to get them to give up their toothbrushes. And so here's what they did. They paid an actor. Gave this guy money to come in, and his job was to convince the young people not to brush their teeth anymore. And he was good. He had PowerPoint slides. He had microscopic pictures of these bacteria in their mouth. I mean, he was ready. And so what they did was they divided the student body up into six groups. And for ease of me telling you tonight, we'll say each group had 100 students. The very first group got nothing. They literally didn't tell him anything. They simply just said, hey, we want you to go listen to this guy. And for an hour, he went on about how the components of toothpaste cause cancer and how the bristles of a toothbrush can leave pits that bacteria can grow in. And then he'd show him a picture of those bacteria. And he was good. And by the end of that hour, those kids were ready to give up their toothbrush. Group number two. Right before they sent them in, they gave them a reminder. They said, you know, you've been told since you were little that brushing your teeth is good for you. We want you to go listen to this guy. And they sent them in. And again, this guy goes on and talks about all of the dangers involved in brushing your teeth. And at the end of the hour, guess what? Most all of them gave up the toothbrush. Group number three, they got that reminder. But they were also warned. They were actually told, we're going to send you into a room where there's a guy who's going to try to get you to give up your toothbrush. They sent them in. Group number four got the reminder. They got the warning. But notice this. They also got the guy's arguments. They actually told him, they said, we're going to send you into this room where this guy's going to try to get you to give up your toothbrush. He's going to tell you that the components of toothpaste cause cancer and that the bristles of that brush will leave pits where bacteria can grow. They sent them in. Group number five, they got the reminder. They got the warning. They got the arguments. But notice this, they even got answers to the guy's arguments. They said, he's going to tell you the components of toothpaste cause cancer, but he's not going to tell you that you got to eat like 78 gallons a day in order for it to cause cancer. He's going to tell you that the bristles of a toothbrush will leave pits that bacteria can grow in, but he's not going to tell you that enamel is one of the toughest substances in the world. They sent them in. The very last group got all of that. They got the reminder, the warning, the arguments, the answers to the guy's arguments. But right before they sent them in, they gathered them up and said, look, this guy may show you some things that we haven't talked about. He may show you some pictures that we haven't discussed, but that doesn't change the real fact that brushing your teeth is good for you. So what we want you to do is we want you to go listen to him with a critical mind, with the understanding that brushing your teeth is good for you. Now, if I asked you tonight, which group do you think did the best? Obviously, number six, right? Why? Because they were inoculated. Which group do you think did the worst? Now, we would normally say group one. Believe it or not, it was actually group two, the one that just got the reminder. And you say, okay, Brad, what's your point? Who cares? Why are we talking about toothbrushes? Folks, listen to me. If a paid actor can get your child or grandchild to give up their toothbrush after an hour, what do you think a professor can do to their faith in a semester? That's why we're talking about it. And here's the scary thing to me. The group that did the worst, the group that just got that reminder, to me that sounds an awful lot like Christian parents saying, we've told you since you were little that God is real. Now, go get your diploma. And we've got lots of our kids who are giving up their spiritual toothbrush. I mean, you think about it for just a moment. Within the church, how much emphasis do we put on children, on babies? We get excited. We throw showers for babies. We love them. We prepare, right? My question is, are we really preparing for that next step? Because, folks, our kids need to be prepared to step out into eternity. And in far too many cases, they're not. The reality is, everybody in this room is going to leave a legacy. Whether you like it or not, you're leaving a legacy. The question tonight is, what is the legacy that you're leaving through your kids? What do I mean by that? I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the solution. I had breakfast with a lot of the guys in this room, and I really, really appreciated some of the comments that they were making, because we kept bringing it back to one place. You know where that was? To the home. Most people don't like to think of it that way. When we talk about all the issues like same-sex marriage and abortion and all these things, we think that maybe Washington ought to fix that. Well, guess what? You want to fix it? Where do we start? In the home. You say, Brad, that doesn't do any good. Let me tell you what. I got four kids who have heard lessons repeatedly on things like abortion and same-sex marriage. And I know where they're going to stand. And then when they get married, I expect their spouses to hold the same beliefs and for them to raise a tribe of warriors, Christian warriors, who hold the same beliefs. You want to fix the problem, we start in the home. I think sometimes we expect to pull a switch in an election and have that guy fix everything. And what we're doing is we're taking the responsibility from ourselves that God has placed on us, and we're transferring it to somebody else. Well, folks, that's not biblical. Tonight, let's look for just a minute at some of the problem and the solution. Let's start with the parents. If I were to ask you, what kind of parent are you? We got a lot of people who are absent parents. Now, what do I mean by that? These are folks who basically, when it comes to training their kids, they're not there. They're not teaching. They're not training. And the Bible actually speaks about this. You look in Proverbs chapter 29, verse 15. It says, "The rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother." You know, 45 years ago, this was unheard of. 25 years ago, we came up with a new name for it. Some of you know the name. Latchkey children. Anybody remember that term? There are some of you in this room that may have gone to school with a house key tied around your neck, or a house key hidden under the, you know, we always put them under the mat, don't we? Or under a flower pot. And you come home and mom's not there. Dad's not there. And so who's raising the child? They're raising themselves. This would be absent parenting. Another one is haphazard parenting. These would be people who may want to do a good job. They may want to have Christian young people, their children, and yet they don't have a vision. They don't have a plan. And in fact, all they're doing, quite literally, is going all the time, basically keeping up with the world. This is the person who, on Monday night, they've got soccer practice, and on Tuesday night, they've got to go to recital. Wednesday night, they've got a church if the homework is done. Thursday night, they've got to be somewhere, and they're constantly going, and they never slow down to actually put a plan together of how I'm going to train up my child, how I'm going to teach my child and get them to heaven. What about this one? Abusive parenting. This would be somebody who quite literally is using threats, using fear, in order to try to make sure their child is in a church building. Folks, let me tell you something. If you are using this method, you're failing. Because the minute your child gets out from under you, they will not just turn away, they'll run. And they're gone. Somebody show me where it says in the Bible that we're to use fear and that we're used to use threats in order to spread the word. You won't find it. How about this one? Spineless parenting. Folks, this one right now is epidemic in the United States of America. Spineless parenting, basically allowing the child to make up all the rules. Now, you think about it. How many young people are making the decisions in their home for what they wear or what they watch on television? You know, I can see me trying to tell my dad when I was about 10 or 11, no, Dad, I'm going to do this. You know how long that would have lasted? About that long. And after I was picking myself up off the ground and apologizing to my dad, and yet we've got kids that talk to their parents like the parents are dirt. Now, as a side note to this one, what about friendly parenting? I mentioned to the men this morning that part of the problem is some of my generation, they want to be friends with their kids. And so instead of actually parenting the children, what they're doing is they're wanting to play games and be buddies, and they don't ever want to tell them no. What happens to a child that doesn't have discipline? What we need, and what I'm calling everybody in this room to be, is a deliberate parent. And right now there's some older people in this room saying, my days of parenting are long gone. If you got your Bible, pick it up, open it up to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Look with me at verse 9. Only take heed to yourself, diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and your what? Your grandchildren. Wait a second, you mean I've got a responsibility after my child hits 18 and leaves the home? Folks, as long as they've got a breath in their lung, you have a responsibility to them. And we've got to get out of this mindset that when little Billy hits 18 years of age and he walks out the door, then my job is done. So for all of the older people in this room, let me ask you this question on a very serious note. What have you done in the last week for the spiritual welfare of your grandchildren? I'll share with you very quickly. There's a lady in Montana right now. She's a member of the church. She is in the early stages of Alzheimer's. She told me, she said, Brad, every single month I write my grandchildren. It cost me 46 cents per grandchild. She writes them a letter, but in that letter she also includes Bible questions. She said, I've become pen pals with my grandkids. I love it. Not only are they writing her back every month, they're keeping those letters. And she's doing a dialogue with her grandkids about biblical matters. Lady in Texas uses email. It's cheaper. It's free. And so every single week, she is emailing her grandchildren, checking in with them, but not just checking in with them. She also is including Bible study material. What we've got to be is deliberate parents and grandparents. Parenting with a purpose. What does that mean? That means that we must teach our children with zeal, with passion, to teach their children, to teach their children, to teach their children until Jesus Christ comes back. Because as I'm looking out at everybody in this room, I don't think you want to be the one who breaks that chain about getting your family to heaven. Again, open your Bible to Psalm chapter 78. Psalm chapter 78. We'll look at two very distinctly different groups of people. Psalm 78, starting in verse 1. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known. And our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength, his wonderful works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. Okay, look at what's going on here. He is talking about teaching children that haven't even been born yet. That with forethought and with planning, they're going to make sure future generations are taught about the Lord. Now, skip just two verses down to verse 9. The children of Ephraim, being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law, and they forgot his works and his wonders that he had shown them. Here you've got two distinct groups. You've got one group that's saying, we're going to teach our children and even the children unborn. And then you've got the children of Ephraim who, during the day of battle, they literally just set down their weapons and they don't uphold the law of God. Why? Folks, I would suggest to you, the difference is what they saw in their parents. You got one group of parents that says, we're going to teach our kids about God. We're going to make sure that even those unborn know about God. And then you got another group, the children of Ephraim, who've looked at their parents, and when the going got tough, you know what they did? They just set it all aside. Simply put, in many homes, we have forgotten that our soul job really is a soul job. And as such, what I'm afraid we've done in the church is we have actually gotten so wrapped up in being a part of the world that we don't slow down very much anymore. And all we're using our homes for is basically a pit stop. I mean, think about it for just a moment. How many times do we just grab a quick meal and we're not doing any training, any nurturing, any mentoring? And you say, well, Brad, you don't understand. I mean, times are different. Folks, listen to me. You got the same number of hours in a day that the Apostle Paul did. You got the same number of hours in a day that Jesus Christ did. Times may be different because of the way we prioritize things. You say, oh, but I'm training my child at McDonald's. Okay, let me point out something to everybody in this room. I travel about 42 weekends a year. And I get to, when I travel, a lot of times I'm forced to eat out. A lot of times I'm at restaurants like that I would rather not be at. And I people watch. You know, I've never seen anybody training up their child in the nurture and admonition of the Lord at McDonald's. Hadn't happened. Hadn't seen it. Now, I have seen this. I have seen a family of four walk into a restaurant, sit down, and never communicate with one another because they all had a device. Child had a PS2 video game. Daughter had some kind of an iPod. Mom and dad both have their cell phones. One's talking on it, the other's surfing on it. Only time this family ever stopped to communicate was when a waitress came over and took their order. They never spoke to one another. You say, but Brad, you know, it's not in Scripture that we've got to sit at our table. And I would somewhat agree with that. We're going to look at a passage here, though, in a minute. But my question is, okay, if we're not sitting around a table together anymore, when are we training our kids? Because, folks, let's be honest for a minute. We wake up, we send them off to school. They come home, they've got homework. If we're not sitting around the table, at what point are we actually putting God's word into their heart? Take a look at Psalm 128. Psalm 128. Blessed are all who fear the Lord, who walk in obedience to him. You'll eat the fruit of your labor. Blessings and prosperity will be yours. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Around your what? Around your table. Yes, this will be the blessing for the man who fears the Lord. If you back up one chapter before that, Psalm 127, verse 4, like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Look at the picture that the inspired psalmist is painting right here. Our children are like God's arrows, and we are like the archers. The question being, what direction are we actually pointing them? Because, folks, if we are not with forethought and determination shooting them towards that bullseye called heaven, they're not going to make it, especially given today's environment. Now, the question becomes, all right, Brad, you say we need to be deliberate parentings. Deliberate parents, what does that look like? What does it mean in the year 2013 in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, to be a deliberate parent? First and foremost, it entails prayer. If you are not praying for your children and with your children, number one, shame on you. Number two, start doing it. Your kids need to hear you praying. Why? Multiple reasons. Number one, they need to hear what is on your heart petitioning to God. Number two, how do you expect them to learn to pray and to communicate with a father if they don't ever hear mom or dad doing it? My encouragement to everybody in this room, you need to start praying before the child's ever born. Praying for them, over them. Are we praying for our children? It's funny, in this room, I suspect all the people who have children and grandchildren, you want them to marry a faithful spouse. How many times do they hear you praying for that? To them, over them. Next, deliberate parenting entails a good example. This one, I tell you what, folks, I cannot stress the importance of this. Every single weekend I go and I preach a sermon or two. But you know that child has watched a sermon all week long in your house. And your actions normally are a lot louder than whatever I can say from this pulpit right here. And so if you are telling your children, hey, we're Christians and God is important, but you don't attend Sunday night worship because after all you're tired and you got other stuff to do, guess what? You're preaching a sermon to them. Or if you say, we're a Christian, we're a Christian family, we go to the church, and then maybe on Monday night you're turning on a television show that is ungodly, you are preaching a sermon to them. That basically we can be a Christian in name on Sunday, but we're going to take that off and be just like the world the rest of the week. We have got to set a good example. One of the things, and let me make sure everybody in here hears me loud and clear. I am very, 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 very far from being a perfect man. My family will be the first to tell you, I make a lot of mistakes. But one area that I am very passionate about is that the man that stands up here in front of you is the same man that my four children see in our home when nobody's looking. Because, folks, there is nothing worse than our kids hearing us say one thing and then watching us do something else. Next, it entails instruction. You say, what kind of instruction? I mean, after all, Brad, it's not like kids come with a book. They don't have an instruction book, a manual. I would disagree with you. I would say we got a pretty good one right here. In fact, if I were to ask you, what should we expect from, say, about a 6 or 7 year old? According to this book, open up to 1 Samuel chapter 3. Let's learn a little something. 1 Samuel chapter 3. I'm going to start reading in verse 1. Listen to what the Bible says. Now the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation. It came to pass at that time while Eli was lying down in his place, when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see, before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, while Samuel was lying down, that the Lord called Samuel. And he answered, here am I. And he ran to Eli and he said, Here I am, for you called me. And he said, I didn't call. Lie down again. And he went and he lay down. Then the Lord called yet again, Samuel. So Samuel arose and he went to Eli and he said, here I am, for you called me. And he answered, I didn't call, my son. Lie down again. Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. And the Lord called Samuel a third time. So he rose and he went to Eli and he said, here I am, for you did call me. And then Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, go and lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. Probably everybody in here very familiar with that passage. I want us to look at three things that we can glean from that. Keeping in mind, most scholars who are familiar with this text and what's going on would put Samuel somewhere about 6 or 7 years of age. This is a young boy. By 6 or 7, what should we as parents be able to expect? Number one, Samuel obeyed. Look at his example. The Lord called Samuel and he said, what? Here am I. He didn't do what some of our kids would do and say, what do you want, Mom? Leave me alone. He obeyed. He said, here I am. Not just that, notice this. He was fully respectful. He obeyed. He said, here I am. What did Eli tell him? Go do what? Go lay down. What did he do? He went and lay down. He ran to Eli and said, here I am, for you called me. You want to see how well this works at your house? Tonight about 1 o'clock in the morning, wake your child up. See how well they respond to you. Don't do it. Just play. Some in the back going, oh no. My point is, this is a young man who fully respected authority. He respected adults. He wasn't going to roll over and go, leave me alone. Why are you waking me up? Number three, once he learned about God, he was responsive to him. Folks, by the age of 6 or 7, our children need to understand this world is not all about them. We got a lot of young people who think the world revolves around them. Guess what? It revolves around Jehovah God. And they need to understand that from a very young age. You say, okay, Brad, I hear what you're saying. But still, that you just got us to age 6. Oh, we're going to get a little older. Just wait. Because somewhere between 6 and teenage years, you're probably going to start needing to do a little bit. In fact, if you wait until 6 to start, you've missed the boat completely. But you need to discipline your children. This morning we had a conversation with the men talking about the fact that in the old days, you got in trouble, what happened? You got what I call a board of education meeting, right? We don't do that as much anymore. In fact, we have this new thing called time out. Because after all, we can't hurt their self-esteem. Folks, let me tell you what. Had my parents tried time out, I would have been in the corner thinking of how can I do it next time and not get caught? But my dad was smarter and loved me more than that. We occasionally had Board of Education meetings where I left thinking, ooh, I probably should never do that again. Let me show you what the Bible actually says, because I think we've forgotten this in the church. Proverbs 23, verses 13 and 14. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you strike him with a rod, he will not die. If you strike him with a rod, you will save his soul from Sheol. Here is the point that I think is trying to be made in this passage. If you love your child, you will rein them in. Why? Because a disobedient child to the Lord is the same as an atheist, as a homosexual, as a, you name the worst thing that you can. And he is lumping a disobedient child in that same category. And if you don't believe me, pick up your Bible and turn to Romans chapter 1. Let me just prove it to everybody. Romans chapter 1, Paul here, writing to the Christians at Rome, Take a look with me, starting at verse 28. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. He's now going to give you a list of things that aren't fitting. Verse 29, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliceness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things. What's the next one? Disobedient to parents. Folks, I need you to hear what I'm saying this evening. Paul is putting disobedient children into the same category as haters of God, as murderers, and homosexuals. Now, let's be honest. We get in pulpits like this all the time, and we preach out against immorality, and we, you know, amen. Okay, when's the last time we've talked about our kids who are running around crazy, knocking over elderly people who are scared to come to the building because they may actually break a pelvic bone? Well, shame on us. Because what Paul is saying right here is, get your children in line. Not so that you can brag, but so that they can be disciplined and understand there is an authority bigger than them, God. Proverbs 23 again, do not withhold discipline from a child. If you strike him with a rod, he will not die. If you strike him with a rod, you'll save his soul from Sheol. What about this one? This one's the harder one. Deliberate parenting entails consistency and persistence. Folks, anybody in this room who is a good parent will tell you parenting is hard. It's easy to be the kind of parent that says, just go watch a movie. But good parenting is hard. I'm going to tell a story on my kids, and they probably won't like it, but that's all right. They have to put up with Dad. We used to live in a house that had a door in the garage that went to our backyard, and they would always go out there and play on their swing set and their trampoline, whatever. But they always left that door open. Every time they went out. And it's not that big a deal, except that Dad doesn't like animals, like mice and rats and snakes and raccoons and possums and other critters. And so I always told him, close the door. We don't want stuff coming in the garage. Close the door. And they couldn't get it. So one evening I gathered them up. During our Bible time, I said, look, that door gets left open again. All of you are going to have a little Board of Education meeting. A couple days go by. Every night I do the same thing in my house. I always check all the doors, make sure they're locked. I go out, I look, sure enough, it's wide open. That's like 10:30 at night. And my children have already been asleep now for an hour, maybe hour and a half. And it would have been so easy. It probably would have taken me all of maybe 15 seconds to step out, reach out, pull the door, lock it, and step back in. Been done. But they wouldn't have gotten the message. So that evening, about 10:30, I got to wake up four children sleeping. We had a Board of Education meeting. And I'll have you know, that door got shut every single night from then on. Consistency. Persistence. You say, okay, Brad, I hear what you're saying, but give me a biblical example. How about the master teacher? That's a pretty good one, isn't it? Take a look, Luke chapter 2. Let's learn about consistency, persistence. What can we learn or expect from a 12-year-old? I'm going to start reading in verse 41. His parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. When they had finished the days as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem. Joseph and his mother did not know it, but supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey. They sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. So when they didn't find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. Now so it was that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. Apparently, according to the text, Jesus was away from his parents at least 3 days. Most scholars would say five. And the reason I say five, it was a day's journey out, a day's journey back, and the text says after 3 days they found him. That's five. That means you got a 12-year-old boy who for 5 days took care of himself. Let me restate that. 12 years old, and he could completely take care of himself. What is it we should be able to expect from a 12-year-old? First and foremost, we should expect our 12-year-olds to have a sense of responsibility, purpose, and destiny. In other words, by 12 years of age, they need to understand that there's a bigger plan. There is a God, and they need to be responsible enough to handle themselves in whatever situation they find themselves. Not only that, we should expect our 12-year-olds to have a burning hunger to understand the truth and pursue wisdom. You know, Jesus could have gone anywhere in Jerusalem. Let's be honest. He could have gone to the entertainment side of town. He could have gone to wherever the kids were gathered to play games. And yet, this is a young man who wanted knowledge. I'm going to say something that's probably not popular, but I'm not here for a popularity contest. I think one of the things where we have failed in the church is we keep pulling our kids away from the older people. Church, listen to me. They need to learn from the older people, just like Jesus Christ is doing here. And if we're constantly pulling them out in a group all by themselves, and that's all they associate with the church, number one, that isn't the full church. Number two, how can we say they're learning from the older? Here you've got Jesus Christ. He's learning. He's wanting wisdom. Number three, we should expect our 12-year-olds to be totally obedient. We saw a little bit of this with Samuel. You say, Brad, it doesn't say anything about obedience. Let me tell you something. If you were misbehaving in the temple, I guarantee you would have been thrown out, period. You didn't go running and playing and goofing around. That was a place of reverence. 12-year-old boy had to be behaving himself. Number four, we should expect our 12-year-olds to be consistently respectful. Again, are our children respecting their elders? Number five, we should expect our 12-year-olds to have a keen sense of discernment, especially with the company they keep. You know, Jesus could have gone to what we call the red light district, couldn't he? If he wanted. But he didn't. Instead, he went with some of the most religious people of the day. We should expect our kids by the age of 12 to realize it matters who I hang out with. It matters whose company I keep. It blows my mind. In the church, sometimes we wait until our kids are 16, 17, 18 to start teaching on things like marriage and dating. Folks, you've missed it by then. Because you need to be teaching them when they're 10, 11, 12, it matters who you hang out with. So that when they hit 16, 17, 18, they already realize, I don't need to be hanging out with certain people because I may end up marrying them. And that may end up causing me to leave the church. Number six, we should expect our 12-year-olds to be totally committed to do the will of God. By 12 or 13, folks. Our kids need to understand that it's okay to want a career. It's okay to go after and pursue what we call the American dream. But they also need to understand they were put here for a purpose. It's a much bigger purpose than just trying to run the race, the rat race, as we call it. And so by 12, 13 years of age, our kids need to understand I'm here to be a servant for the Lord. Number seven, we should expect our 12-year-olds to have an unmistakable godliness in their life. In other words, by 12, 13, 14 years of age, somebody ought to be able to look at them in a school setting and say, that one's different. That one's not like everybody else. And yet, what do our 12, 13, 14-year-olds really look like today? I mean, you think about what they're listening to, you think about what they're watching, you think about the video games they're playing, and basically, folks, our 12, 13, 14-year-olds have just blended right on in with the world. The last slide that I want to show you before I let you guys take a short break is this. I started out by talking about we have to inoculate them. What that means is, as parents, as deliberate parents, we need to make sure that our kids have four things in hand before they ever leave our house. The very first pillar is that our kids need to be able to prove God exists. I guarantee you, this congregation would be blown away if you knew how many young people in this congregation, really deep down, they can't prove God is real. They believe in Him. They think He's real because mom and dad have told him, but they don't have the tools to prove God is real. Number two, our kids need to be able to prove the Bible is inspired, that it's different from every other book. Because if not, here's what's going to happen. They're going to learn the accounts of this book for 18 years in this building. They're going to run off to the local community college or university. They're going to have to buy a textbook, maybe biochemistry, that costs $232. That's a lot of money. And it's going to seem like that biochemistry book's a whole lot more important than this one, because we haven't taken the time to prove to them the Bible is different. It's more than just a good book. Number three, our kids need to have the evidence that Jesus Christ really did walk this earth. The historical testimony of other people. They need to understand, even an honest atheist will admit, yeah, there was a guy named Jesus here. And he was who he said he was. Now, a lot of times we stop right there. And I think in doing so, we have probably messed up. Because number four, we need to make sure that our kids actually have a relationship. A relationship with God. Prayer. Studying. You know, it's one thing for our kids to be able to give the right answers in a Bible class. It's something else to say they've actually developed their own relationship with God. Because it's on those four pillars that now you can actually build a foundation for New Testament Christianity. You know, my goal, if I could have it, would be everywhere I go speak, there never ever to be any kids lost, ever. I realize right now that's an unrealistic goal, but it doesn't stop me from preaching and teaching and begging parents to engage and to be deliberate. We're going to take about 8-minute break, let you guys get up, stretch your legs. And then we're going to come back and talk about a Christian worldview. Thanks so much for your attention thus far.